I'd like to get a copy of that introduction. That was pretty awesome. Thank you, David. It was such a delight when David visited me in Port Townsend some time ago, and then when I got an email from him recently inviting me here, I was really, really pleased. And anyway, thank you all for coming today. I don't know whether in the back you can hear me. Can you hear me? You can't? Okay. If you can, I'll be happy to speak up. David pretty much summarized it. So, do you have any questions?
Maybe you can introduce the figures on the wall, Bill, in case you don't know what to say.
Oh, yeah. David brought a Tonka here. Who's that? Is that Avalokiteshvara?
That's Manjushri.
That's Manjushri. Okay. And then that's Avalokiteshvara?
Yes. So Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom in the Buddhist traditions. It represents the perfection of wisdom. On the left, on the right, Avalokiteshvara, who is a protagonist in the Heart Sutra. Bill will tell us more about that, the bodhisattva of compassion.
Yeah. This is the Heart Sutra idea, I guess, is that this is the heart of this teaching of Prajnaparamita. I made up this little card so people will go home. You'll have pretty much on this little card summarized everything I'm going to say here today. So if you fall asleep or your memory's not so good, don't worry. It's all right here. And I've divided the sutra into four sections. The first part introduces the teaching of Prajnaparamita. And the second introduces the Abhidharma. And the third, the Bodhisattva path. And finally, the mantra that makes up the womb of the Buddhas. Prajnaparamita, the word probably maybe around 200 BC, 100 BC, right in that range, the Buddha started talking about Prajnaparamita. It's an old word. Hindus use it, a lot of people use it, and it just means, you know, wisdom. But around 200 BC, these Buddhists in northern India, maybe around Pakistan, started using it with a different meaning. They decided that there were different kinds of prajna, different kinds of wisdom. And we all know that we all have our own intuitive wisdom that we get used to get by in our daily lives. And this is sort of like mundane wisdom, knowing how to do things as a human being. But then there's a group of people who developed the wisdom of a spiritual path, sort of a metaphysical wisdom. And then there's this wisdom, which goes beyond the metaphysical, to Prajnaparamita. And so to distinguish it, these early Buddhists added this word paramita on the end of it to say this is not just your regular mundane prajna or your transcendent prajna. This is ultimate, special prajna. So paramita means really great wisdom. And they also, in the use of this word, they were distinguishing themselves from other Buddhists of the day. After the Buddha, when the Buddha was alive, he would teach people to meditate on stuff in order for them to realize the absence of a self. That's what one of the distinguishing features of Buddhism as opposed to the Hindu religion and the non-belief in a self, in an Atman. And so the Buddha would say, well, meditate on the five skandhas. He came up with this concept, the five skandhas. The Jains had this idea of the skanda too, but they didn't pluralize it. The Jains, the word skandhas is interesting. It means person. It means individual. The original meaning of the word skanda is a tree trunk. And by extrapolation, it was used to describe a pillar, a wooden pillar made out of a tree trunk. And so the Jains thought an individual person was a skanda. You have, the skanda is your personality, your individuality, what separates you from the universe. The Buddha came up with a different idea, and that was that we have five skandhas. If you imagine a biology zoology textbook with those overlays, those plastic things you lift up. Well, we are made up of five skandhas. And when I say we, the skandhas don't refer to the body at all. basically doesn't even refer to the what we call the material world. I should go back just a second. In ancient India at the time, the Buddha's day, people thought the universe of, there were, first of all, there were very few materialists in ancient India. Everybody was into the mind in one way or another. And so these people around the Buddha's day cultivated what was called Namarupa. Rupa, of course, is form. Indians still have their coins called the rupee. It's from rupa. And then nama means everything that we can give a name to. Internal constituents, what we would call. So nama rupa was their way of saying outside, inside. As we sit here today, we don't really know where we are as individuals. We know that there's an outside, and we know there's an inside. We don't know exactly how to draw that line, though, where you draw that line to separate outside from inside. And so the Buddha refined this rather simplistic notion of nama-rupa into five different areas in which you could look for the line, look for the place where there might be a self. And so he asked people to meditate on the five skandhas, the five lifting up the overlays. You could say is the self in the form, and form again does not mean the body. It means the external world, and of course it includes your ability to perceive an external world. So it includes the powers of sensation, and the domains in which they function, but not really a body, because again, there's not this belief in materialism in Buddhism like there is in, say, modern Western philosophy, Western civilization. So anyway, he would ask people to meditate on the skandhas and look for a self, and they would come back and say, "Oh, can't find it." And so he would say, "Well, okay, I want you to try something different." And then he would teach them to meditate on the ayatanas, which are the five, which break down the skandhas a little bit differently into your powers of sensation and the domains in which sensation work. And after looking for a self in any of these, not finding any, he would say, well, why don't you try the 18 dhatus, which is just the powers of sensation, the domains in which they work, and their conjunction, where that domain and that power arises, there's a kind of consciousness, like visual consciousness. When the eye and the world of form combine, we have visual consciousness or auditory consciousness. And so people would meditate on these 18 forms or 18 forms of the dhatus, not find a self, and then they would come back and say, still no self. And so the Buddha would go on like this and give people stuff to meditate on and sort of try to get them to exhaust themselves looking for the self to the point where they would give it up. They would give up the self. And this was sort of the early regimen of early Buddhism. This was his way of teaching people. Well, after he entered nirvana, disappeared, the people who, his disciples and their disciples, said, well, yeah, the Buddha did teach us that there's no Atman, but there's, what about these things that we're meditating on? The skandhas, the ayatanas, the dhatus. It's true there's no self in them, but they seem to be real. And so the most prominent of the northern Indian Buddhist sects, the Sarvastivadins, believed that there was these skandhas were real. There was something in them that existed separately from everything else. And so the skandhas actually were real, and the ayatanas and blah, blah, blah. And so when Mahayana Buddhism arose, it arose as a challenge to this view. Not only the Mahayana believed that not only was there no self in our external world, no self in our internal world. There was no self in any sub, any division of our external world or our internal world. Even whether we define it as a human being or as a table, or as vision, an eye, or whatnot. And so Mahayana arose to encourage people to let everything go, not just the idea of self, but anything you would, the realm in which you would even look for a self. And so that's why prajna is such an important word here. These early, the school where people would think that the skandhas were real, the ayatanas were real, dhatus and so forth, these people who did this developed a scheme. Like we have for our supposed material world, we have a table of elements. We think the real world is made up of atoms. And you can see them all right here on this table of 100 or so elements. And the early Buddhists who believed a similar thing with the mind made up what they called the Abhidharma, the matrixes of the Abhidharma, where they had a big table with over 100 what they called dharmas, things that they thought were real, like the skandhas are real, and the ayatanas and the dhatus. They thought that whether you are alive or dead, these things have self-existence, and they persist through time. And so the Buddhists of the early Mahayana said, first of all, let me introduce something. When these people, these early Abhidharma teachers, started writing down texts, they always talked about these entities, these dharmas that you can know, as knowledge, using the word jnana. And when the Mahayana arose, it saw as its real, the real problem was this supposed knowledge. Because knowledge is viewed by the Mahayana as something out there, as an object that I know. And thus, if you're seeking knowledge, you're actually just chasing your tail. And so they came. That's why they came up with this word prajna. The word pra means pre, and jna is short for jnana, knowledge. So prajna means what you know before you know it. Your mind before you know anything, because if you know something, that something is out there, and then I'm the knower. I'm on the inside. We have this problem, subject object, and so the Mahayana arose as a way of getting away from this inherent subject object problem. Even in the spiritual realm, where people were seeking this transcendent knowledge of the skandhas and the ayatanas, they were still stuck chasing their tails. And so this sutra is a critique of that early Abhidharma approach, and introduces in its place the teaching of the mind, of cultivating the mind before it knows anything, before you know anything. And later in Zen masters, this teaching arose around 100, 200 BC. Zen developed in southern India, perhaps, and eventually ended up in China, but not until around 500 AD. And when Zen finally developed, it preferred not to use texts like this because they could be so conceptual. And Zen masters would ask people, or tell their disciples, what is your original face? Who is your real mother and father? To try to get them to understand this moment of when you know something before you know it. Who's the person who, or where was the mind before you knew anything? Who were you before you knew anything? Your original face. And then to shake people up and to make them make that leap, they would say, have a cup of tea. Or go wash the dishes. Stop thinking. Stop messing around with this object, subject, this eternal cycle that you can't get away from. So this sutra was composed to encapsulate all the teachings, the basic understanding of the Abhidharma, and to contrast it with with what the Mahayana had in mind as a way of getting around this. And so you see the Heart Sutra begins with this Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. And when Prajnaparamita, this wisdom tradition arose, the Buddhists believed that there are these transcendent beings called bodhisattvas. And the bodhisattva who's sort of in charge of all the wisdom teachings is Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom. But oddly enough, when we get this the heart of wisdom teaching itself, we don't see Manjushri. We get another bodhisattva, a bodhisattva called Avalokiteshvara. And a lot of people have wondered, what is Avalokiteshvara doing, giving this teaching of Prajnaparamita and contrasting it with the Abhidharma? And I thought about this for quite a while and came up with my own theory. It's just my own theory. It's something no legitimate scholar would ever dare put into print. But the fact is that the Buddha never taught the Abhidharma on this planet. On the seventh year of his ministry, he ascended, he spent the summer monsoon every day. He would go, leave the planet and go up to the top of Mount Sumeru, and where he taught his mother the Abhidharma. And every day he would come back down for a short time and teach Shariputra, one of his famous disciples. He would teach Shariputra a summary of the Abhidharma. And then he'd go back up, teach his mother more about the Abhidharma, because because the Abhidharma is how the mind works when the mind is looked at, analyzed into constituent elements. As long as you understand these elements are not real, there's no harm in this. But of course, the people on Earth weren't quite as wise as either the Buddha or the Buddha's mother. And so the Buddha's mother got all these teachings of the Abhidharma. Shariputra got the summaries. And then when the monsoon ended, the Buddha never again spoke about the Abhidharma. There is no Abhidharma text attributed to the Buddha. None whatsoever. Lots of other texts, but no Abhidharma texts. But when we get our first Abhidharma texts, Shariputra is almost always associated with their composition, with all the early texts, or most of the early Abhidharma texts. And so it occurred to me that if you were going to compose a sutra that was going to criticize the Abhidharma, you would want the Buddha's mother to attack Shariputra, or straighten out Shariputra. And so to me, this is why Avalokiteshvara is in this sutra. This is, you might say, an incarnation of the Buddha's mother. And of course, Avalokiteshvara has the odd distinction of being both male and female. I don't know of any other major bodhisattva who has that ability. And so I think this reflects this amorphous, ambiguous state of the Buddha's mother who dies right after the Buddha was born, goes up, lives as a deva on Mount Sumeru in the Triad Trinsha heavens, and then receives this teaching, and then comes down to teach this sutra to Shariputra, to straighten out his understanding of the Abhidharma. So that's why I think Avalokiteshvara is in this sutra. But again, that's just my reading of the texts. And also, it's interesting that this text is organized in a way that agrees with the early texts of the Sarvastivada and Abhidharma. And no other school had their list of Abhidharma categories in the same order as the Sarvastivadins. And so this text was composed with line by line. It goes through all the early texts of the Abhidharma of the Sarvastivadins and criticizes them one after another in the same order that the Sarvastivadins studied them. Anyway, so that's my little background theory. You don't really need to accept it to understand the sutra, but I like to just throw it out there just to explain why is Avalokiteshvara in this sutra. And Avalokiteshvara, the name is really crucial for an understanding of the sutra. The word Avalo means to look down upon. And of course, if you're the Buddha's mother on top of Mount Sumeru, you're definitely looking down. Because that Mount Sumeru is at the height, the pinnacle of the realm of form, looking down upon the world, looking down upon on mankind. So the noble Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, while practicing the deep practice of Prajnaparamita, looked upon the five skandhas. Again, the verb here is avaloka. So Avalokiteshvara avalokas. Avalokiteshvara means to look down upon, and what she or he does is to cultivate or embody his or her own name. That is to look down upon. So Avalokiteshvara looks upon the five skandhas, these five possible ways of looking at our individuality, either as and looking for a self in the external world, you know, the skanda of form, or the internal world, the skandhas of sensation, perception, memory, and consciousness. And so he looks upon the five skandhas and sees that they are empty of self-existence. Self-existence, the word svabhava in Sanskrit, sva means self. It's sort of a more refined self than the Atman self. Atman self belongs to a person. Sva is just anything that might have its own self-identity, separate in space or time or conception from other things. So Avalokiteshvara sees that these skandhas, everything that makes up our universe, keep this in mind that the skandhas do not represent our physical body, have nothing to do with it. It's our awareness of our universe. When we wake up in the morning, even when we're asleep, there's something going on. We don't know what it is, but there we are. We find ourselves there every day. We find ourselves right here. We don't know who we are. We don't know how big we are. How big is the mind? What color is it? We don't know, but we have a sense that there's an outside and there's an inside. And because we think we're so special, we think the inside is surely more interesting than the outside. So we have one outside, the skanda of form, and then we have these four insides. Well, we have sensation, and we have perception, and we have memory, and consciousness. We are conscious. We're all here today. We all are conscious. And we've had our present consciousness is based upon previous states of consciousness, which is the skanda of memory. And those previous states of consciousness are based upon, comprised of our perceptions of previous states of consciousness. And those perceptions are made up of sensations, and those sensations are made up of the idea that there's an external world and an internal world. And so this is this universe that Avalokiteshvara is looking down upon. Again, there's no limit to the skandhas. They're not limited to our body. They're not limited to this world. They're infinite, just as our minds are infinite. There's no top to our minds or bottom to our minds. But we have learned to think of our minds as somehow in our bodies. A lot of people say, well, my mind must be in my brain. Or the Chinese used to think the mind is in right about here, in what they call your dantian. But the mind actually has no location. And so, but Avalokiteshvara is looking down upon this universe of our awareness as divided into five different overlays, and sees that they are empty of self-existence. So not only is there no Atman, that these skandhas individually have no self-existence. So this is the Buddhist concept of emptiness. You've heard it a lot. It's an easy term to misunderstand. The Indians had problems with the word shunyata, the Sanskrit word shunyata, which means emptiness. They were always having to explain it because it was so easily misinterpreted. When it was translated into Chinese, it was translated with the Chinese word kong. And the Chinese had the same problem with the word kong. And they were always having to explain this word to other Chinese people because it's so easily misunderstood in Chinese. And now that we're in translating kong, or shunyata, into emptiness in English, we have the same problem trying to make sure people don't misunderstand what this word means. Because most people, when they first see this word, they think, oh, emptiness, yeah, nothing, nothingness. And that's exactly the opposite of what emptiness means. Because emptiness, you see in this line, emptiness means empty of something, empty of self-existence. So self-existence is to draw a line around your body and say, this is my self-existence, or that tape, that podium has self-existence, or whatever, the skandhas have self-existence. They exist separately from each other in some way, in some undefined way in space or time. They have self-existence. But the Amalekitesvara says, no, they are empty of self-existence. The skandhas cannot really have no real separation from one another in time or in space. They're empty of self-existence, and this is the Buddhist concept of emptiness. So emptiness doesn't mean nothing. It means empty of one particular thing. So if you say something has self-existence, you're negating the rest of the universe. You're saying this has self-existence, therefore everything outside of this has been negated somehow. You've separated this from the universe in space or in time or in your mind. So you've negated something. So what the word emptiness does, when you say empty of that negation, it's a double negation. You're negating the negation. That's what the word emptiness is. It's a double negation. It doesn't mean empty of just anything, but empty of negation, empty of self-existence, which is the ultimate negation, whereby you affirm an individuality, but in order to affirm that individuality, you have to negate the rest of the universe. And so this is what Avalokiteshvara sees, that these skandhas have no self-existence. They are empty of self-existence. It doesn't deny the skandhas, just says, well, skandhas, you know, we can use them. They're a very useful tool in cultivation, in meditation, but they do not exist by themselves. They're empty of self-existence. And then the sutra says, and seeing that they were empty of self-existence, Avalokiteshvara said, here, Shariputra, right here. This is sort of like the Zen master's slap, or the have a cup of tea, right here. So bring the entire universe of your awareness right here, to this very moment, here, in this our awareness of these skandhas that we think make up our universe of awareness, right here, Shariputra. Form, which is the first of the skandhas, form is emptiness. Is empty, and again, emptiness means empty of self-existence. Emptiness is form. And then it goes through this little thing that always confuses people, and with good reason. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Emptiness is not separate from form. Form is not separate from emptiness, and whatever is form is emptiness, whatever is emptiness is form. This is, again, this sutra is aimed at a specific group of people. It's aimed at the Sarvastivadis, who were very, what should we say, they were into logic. Logic played a very important role in certain sects of early Buddhism. And so this statement, some of you have probably studied mathematics, and you've studied set theory. Well, these three lines here is a statement of set theory, where you say form is emptiness, emptiness is form. You're simply saying A and B intersect. If emptiness is A and form is B, to say that A is B and B is A, you're just saying that these two sets intersect. And then when you say they're not separate from each other, you're saying not only do they intersect, they are identical. A and B are identical. But there's still a loophole that the Sarvastivadins could have gotten out of. And so the third statement has to be added, because you could have an A prime and a B, a sub B, or whatever. You could have different kinds of A, different kinds of B. different kinds of emptiness, different kinds of form. So to make sure that Avalokiteshvara, to make sure he gets across his point, he says, whatever is A is B. Whatever is B is A. And again, so don't be too confused by this linguistic mumbo-jumbo. Mm-hmm. It's actually not mumbo-jumbo. It's just a statement of set theory designed to show us that there's no way to get away from the statement that Avalokiteshvara sees that the skandhas are empty of self-existence, and therefore, there's no lines around them. And when you remove the lines, the separation is gone. I always think about of emptiness as a mental net, or at least what it's trying to do. In our lives, we cast this mental net around our universe, whereby we separate each other from ourselves. We separate the chairs from the floor. We separate the ceiling and so forth. Our physical world and our mental world, our emotional worlds. But emptiness, the function of emptiness is to take that net and to pull it off. So what remains is not nothing. It's everything. It's just everything devoid of any ability to separate one entity from another. This is emptiness. This is empty of self-existence, empty of separation, empty of division. And so this is why Avalokiteshvara introduces this concept of emptiness in regard to the universe that the Sarvastivadins had divided their awareness into the skandhas, for example. And so goes through this sequence identifying A and B as being identical and always will be identical and always were identical, and then says the same holds for the other skandhas, sensation, perception, memory, and consciousness. And again says, here, this very awareness, this very moment, Shariputra, all dharmas are defined by emptiness. This is their one characteristic all dharmas share, is they have no self-existence. They are empty of self-existence. So you can talk about dharmas, and the word dharma is simply a word that became commonly used by people cultivating a spiritual path. And you could actually take the word dharma and refer to a floor or a table or this card right here. Because dharma just means anything you can grasp. But people who cultivate know that these are sort of the illusions, because I can rip this card up and it doesn't exist anymore. And so they believe that the real things were these mental things. If you sit there, you have feelings, and you start analyzing your feelings, or you start analyzing thoughts, and you get this other world of dharmas. That's why I call it the metaphysical world of dharmas. And most Buddhists, when they're talking about dharmas, are talking about this metaphysical world of dharmas. So the skandhas, the ayatanas, the dhatus, the Four Noble Truths are dharmas. And so the Avalokiteshvara's comment is, all of these things, regardless of how long you've been meditating on them, you have come to think that they have some kind of self-existence. They don't. They're defined by emptiness. They're not defined by birth or destruction, purity or defilement, completeness or deficiency, because up to that point, the Sarvastivadins and other sects thought this was these were the salient features of any dharma, that it had was subject to birth and destruction, purity or defilement, completeness or deficiency. But the real, true mark, the mula lakshana, the greatest characteristic of all dharmas, is that they're empty of self-existence. And so this is the introduction of the sutra whereby the teaching of Prajnaparamita, or I say the pre-existing teaching of the Abhidharma, is viewed in the light of Prajnaparamita. And then in the second part, Avalokiteshvara then goes through each of the categories of the Abhidharma of the Sarvastivadins and comes up with the same conclusion, that because there's no self-existence, they have no real existence. There's only like an existence you can use the word knows, Yeah, I have a nose, but the nose doesn't really exist in itself. Where does the nose begin? Where does it end in the face? I've done the first part. You might have some questions. I don't want to just sit here and talk all day. Yes.
I've got a question about number 9. The same holds for sensation and perception, memory and consciousness.
Yes.
So when it says that, does it mean that sensation and perception fall under that same logic structure?
Yes. Yes.
And then also the same for memory and consciousness?
Yes.
Somehow intersect together.
Yeah, they don't even intersect because they're not separate. Things intersect when they're separate and somehow come together. But what Avalokiteshvara is saying is they're not separate. So they don't exist apart from one another. But they do exist apart from one another as a useful tool. I mean, we can talk about them. We have these words, but their real existence is not separate. Yes?
Well, I just had a question about the not including bodies as form. In other words, if you're part of my external world, I see you as a form.
Uh-huh.
That's, I see your body. But that's not true for me. I mean, where does the body come into play in this, or does it?
It doesn't.
What did they think of the body? Is it just not exist?
Well, again, All that we know is there's an external world. And we could talk about bodies, certainly, as being form. But so is that chair form. So where's the real form? But all that we know is that there's something outside of us. And you know, we have this body. The Buddhists talk about bodies all the time, too. But they don't talk about them. Even the Sarvastivadins never talked about the body as being real in any sense. But the idea of there being a body is real. To them. That there's an external to me somehow. And I can identify myself with this body. But when I start looking for it, I can't find it. It's not in my hand. And of course, some people don't have hands. They have the idea of self still. David, what do you say about bodies? Do you have a body?
I have a body of knowledge that's very limited, so I'll have to dip into its bag here. I think your answer to this question is really interesting and instructive and uncommon in the tradition.
I should qualify these things I'm saying today.
Yeah. It's because many people will include bodies under the category of rupa. Some translate rupa as materiality, and you're suggesting it's not. But as we know, rupa means forms in a variety of sort of strange metaphysical domains of reality. It can mean size, shape, color, light, those kinds of material things. It also refers to the form realm in ways that almost only quantum mechanics can provide analogies for in our contemporary culture. In my sense, body can be a part of form, but to me, what I hear you saying, and please correct me because I think I may be wrong, what you're saying is rupa doesn't primarily mean bodies.
Yeah.
It means all the various ways that forms as objects of knowledge can manifest in the world. And bodies may be one way, but that it doesn't primarily mean body as opposed to mind.
Yeah, we can have,
for sure.
Form can be defined any way you want to, but the point I want to emphasize is that it all comes back to this feeling you have, that it's outside of you, that you, the real you somehow, is inside, mm-hmm. and form is outside, mm-hmm. and you can identify that with the body, or not. And you can only do it through, you know, we have these powers of sensation, and there's the domains in which they work, and then we can locate forms in the using our powers of sensation, but they have nothing to do with us, you know, ultimately, because we're somehow inside, and they're sort of outside. And again, we know that if I identify with my body as being me, this body is corruptible, it's damageable, and yet I'm still here. So that's why form is always used whenever they're having these discussions as the initial one, just to get across the point that the first of the skandhas is empty of self-existence. The other ones are a little bit harder for us to grasp because they're all internal. Mm-hmm. And there are these ways that the Buddhists came to think about our internal world. Now, modern psychologies have their own way of looking at the internal world. And I'm not conversant with Freud or Jung or Adler enough to know, or even modern psychologists to know how they view our internal world and how they would define it. But however they would define it, Avalokiteshvara would say the same thing. Those entities of our internal world or external world are empty of self-existence. That's all.
The point is, I thought, in reading different things, is to extinguish the duality.
Yes, exactly. At the point, right, no separation, no duality.
That's all?
That's all.
That's the whole point of the discussion.
The whole point of the sutra. No duality. I'm done here. Thank you for talking about it.
We were talking a lot about it, but...
Exactly. I was just talking around it like...
That kind of fits with what I'm thinking. We're talking about dependent existence or dependent arising. And all of this seems like a real complication of a really basic kind of concept. And I'm wondering, what is added to that concept by all of this?
See, the problems with sutras, and they're really great, is that they are addressed to audiences of people who have been screwing around with their minds. going through different teachers and hearing about, oh, my mind is like this, my mind is like that, my mind is like this. And so these sutras are addressed to them to try to get them to stop thinking like that, to stop thinking those things are real. It's true. Yeah. This is sort of the genius of what eventually became to known as Zen. Have a cup of tea. That's the sutra. It makes a lot more sense than reading through these Abhidharma categories and screwing around like that. But again, the sutra was for an audience. And the audience were these practitioners who had been caught up in this web of concepts. And so that's why the sutras can be a bit not easy to read sometimes. Yeah. Because we have to put ourselves in the shoes or the sandals of these people who lived 1,000, 2,000 years ago, who'd spent their lives not watching TV or playing video games, but just sitting on a meditation cushion. Mm-hmm. And that was, we know so much about the latest TV episodes and video games. You can imagine if they had the same focus and focused on their mind, how much they would have to say. And so that's why these sutras have to address that. These people who've been playing mental video games, Abhidharma video games, and trying to get them to put down the controller. Yes?
Well, can I have a question about that? So, in some of these sutras, like the Heart Sutra and the Diamond Sutra, like your translation of the Diamond Sutra, there seems to be something about going through understanding those teachings, the kind of conceptual knowledge sense, and then having that undermined. So it's not just about the here's tea. It's the like, you were caught up chasing your tail for a while. Now here's some tea so you can get out of that.
Yes.
And even in the Korean tradition, stories about masters who spent years studying, then realizing the study was limited, and then coming to some form of enlightenment. So it seems to me that it's not just about the tea. It's about the going through, the chasing the tail, and then the tea.
That's true. The tea doesn't appear out of the middle of nowhere. And when you are offered a cup of tea by a Zen master, you probably have spent a couple of years at the monastery already. You probably don't just walk in the door as a guest and immediately get the magic cup of tea. It's a teaching device. And you might never see that cup of tea. You may just have to wash dishes, depending on the, what the teacher thinks you need to do. Sorry. But it's true. Every teaching, sutras included, are addressed to people on the path at different stages. And they can be useful to people at different stages, but not all stages. Yes?
And isn't the exhorting to have a cup of tea just the clap of, be here now.
Yes.
Be here in the present. Awake to this moment.
Yes. That's exactly
and
mindfulness. What, exactly. There's lots of words for it. But that's why the cup of tea works a lot, because it's not a word. Have a cup of tea. Go wash the dishes. Show me your original face. yes?
Okay, I'm going to try to ask my question. So if sensation, perception, memory, consciousness, and form are all united in their central emptiness, are they all equally distant from the center? Like, are
there's no
sensation
center.
And memory closer, are more alike, or are form and sensation equally the same thing? Because one's inside and one's outside. Is that just like a completely erroneous boundary to create?
Well, actually, form isn't on the outside and the other's on the inside, but we think that.
Well, so are things that are considered inside closer together, or are they in fact as similar to form, which is considered on the outside?
Think of it this way. How big is your mind? It's pretty big, right? It just keeps going. Well, all of that is all of these skandhas coexist simultaneously in that sense you have of your awareness. They're not divided from each other. One's not bigger than the other. They're all big. They're all equally big. What these skandhas are just different ways of looking at that awareness you have right now. If I sit here and say, okay, I've got this, I'm thinking. And okay, I'm going to think about myself as perceiving. Then I'll think about my mind as a perceptual apparatus. That's all. It's just five different ways of looking at this very thought. And then for these early people, the reason why they wanted to look at different ways at it, the Buddha thought people needed to be tired out. And that's why there are five. If he said just look in your one skanda, they would just, I can't find a self. Okay, well, and the impact is greater if you really make somebody tired. And that's why you have five skandhas, and you have 12 ayatanas and 18 dhatus, and the links on the chain of dependent origination. All these things are meant to tire people out, so that they look for something real, they look for a self or something self-existent in all of these different categories, and each of them are identical. They are just this very thought right now. There's no separation. If they are separate, it's an artificial separation you create for some purpose of analysis. And they don't really exist separately.
They being sensation, perception, memory, and consciousness.
Yeah, the five skandhas in this case, or the 12 ayatanas, or the Four Noble Truths. That was the ultimate category of the Sarvastivadins, that the Four Noble Truths had self-existence. And we'll get down to that at the end of part two of this little sutra. Go a little bit more?
Yes.
Okay. Let's go do part two. So having introduced this idea that the skandhas are empty of self-existence, that we can use them as useful categories, and that we can look upon them. Everything looks upon them, It doesn't deny them their possibility of a useful tool, but says they're empty of self-existence, and every other dharma is defined this way. All the dharmas are defined by emptiness, by being empty of self-existence. So therefore, Shariputra, in emptiness, there is no form. And then none of these, in viewed with emptiness, you can't see any division. You can't see where form begins and the other skandhas, sensation, perception, memory, and consciousness begin and end. There's no beginning or end. In emptiness, they don't exist as individual entities. There's no ability to establish any individuality of entities. So therefore, there's no sensation, no perception, no memory, no consciousness. Now what I've done here in my little notes to these things that on the card is I've tried to view them. This is just me saying this. I've viewed these different Abhidharma categories as directed to people with a specific kind of attachment. And so because with the five skandhas you get one external reality and four internal realities, it seems to me that the skandhas would be a good way of tiring people out who are attached to an inner world. Who I say, let's see, their primary sense of reality is mental. When we get down to the next categories, no eye, no ear, these are the 12 ayatanas, the six organs of sense, powers of sensation, and their domains in which they work. These are 10 of these powers and domains take place in what we call the material world. And only the power of the mind and its object, the domain and work in which it works, called thought, are outside that material world. And so they're sort of for people whose primary sense of reality is physical. And then we get the dhatus, which combine the 12 ayatanas with six kinds of consciousness, one kind of consciousness that arises with each power and each domain. So here you get an almost an equal division between the material world and the mental world. And so I think I have in my note that therefore, what are they for? They're for people whose primary sense of reality is both mental and physical. And then we move on to what became known as the 12 links on the chain of dependent origination, where you begin with ignorance and end up with old age and death. And so these are intended for people whose primary sense of reality is logical. You're going from one state to another. Ignorance, memory, consciousness, blah, 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 until old age and death. And then you get to the Four Noble Truths. They're for people whose primary sense of reality, whose primary attachments are ethical, that there is suffering, that there is a relief, is a path leading from suffering. There's a source, right? And there's a relief from suffering, and there's a path of suffering that leads away from suffering. And so what this sutra does in the light of emptiness, none of these things exist as individual entities. Even the Four Noble Truths have no self-existence. And so finally, in line 20, we see the ultimate conclusion here is that there's no knowledge. Again, the Abhidharma was built on the cultivation of jnana, of knowledge. And so the sutra denies knowledge. There's no knowledge. Because if you know it, it's outside you. And you've obviously created a you to go along with that outside. And thus there's also no attainment, no Buddhahood, no enlightenment, and also no non-attainment. And so that last category is for people whose primary sense of reality is spiritual, who are attached to spiritual entities, whether they call it knowledge or whether they call it attainment. So that's sort of applying, using this teaching of emptiness like a light, and shining the light on all these Abhidharma categories. And saying, well, in the light of emptiness, all of this stuff, all the lines disappear. that would separate anything from anything else. So they have no self-existence. We can still talk about these categories, and they still might be useful. We don't usually use them nowadays in our own cultivation in modern Buddhism, but they were the basic categories used in the past to train people to start thinking a bit about their consciousness, their awareness. Yes?
That leads to a practical question. Given we haven't set meditating and playing these games in our mind, what purpose does the Heart Sutra perform today in terms of reciting it and all of that, other than to me, just to get me confused and thinking I'm ignorant, I just don't get it.
The Heart Sutra is the function of the Heart Sutra is for you to be reborn as a Buddha. That's the function. But we haven't got there yet.
We'll
get there. It's a good question. It's why I study the sutra at all. But this has got something at the end which will surprise you. Yes, you have a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering about your personal opinion on this. Do you believe that there is a way for something that exists within emptiness being connected to form and emptiness and having that kind of like power per se combined with like non-awareness for something to actually become separated from emptiness?
Well, we have the idea of ignorance, delusion. The belief that there's something separate is delusion or ignorance. And it's not separate from emptiness, but it's separate from everything else. Because the basic ignorance we all live under is the belief in self, that initial belief in separation of me from others, me from an external world. So, see, emptiness is not a thing. It doesn't exist. It's like what we have done actually is we have created emptiness. We have created the space between each other. And we can use that word emptiness, but the Buddhists don't use the word emptiness about as referring to space or division. They use emptiness referring just to the absence of division, the removal of self-existence, the denial of self-existence, removal of the separation from anything. So emptiness is the absence of any division. So it's normally you might think as a result, well, if there's absence of division, then aren't we all one? Isn't everything one? The Buddhists really don't like that thought at all. Because if we are all one, well, there's something outside the one. It's like if I hug a bunch of people, well, then I can't hug those people over there. And so the Buddhists like to use the term not two. We are all not two. It's a word game. But it's a word game that helps you avoid a word problem, being sucked into the idea that emptiness is itself a thing. And that oneness is somehow a thing. And the Buddhists just say it's non-dual. There's no separation. Not two. In China, you see, there's always gates in front of temples, and very often they'll have a slogan over the gate. And a very common slogan is Bur, not two. You walk through the non-dual gate to get into the monastery. Yes, sir, you have a question?
As you described this, it kind of makes me think of the universe. For me, the universe, everything is connected, everything is not two in the universe.
Yes.
In my mind. I mean, we can divide and say there's planets and suns or blah, 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 but
it's all one big thing.
It's one big, not two thing.
It's
Yes, thank you.
It's really hard to talk about this without getting caught up in it.
Yeah.
It's like punching tar baby. or flypaper, you know.
Yeah.
It's like flypaper. Okay. You know, it's so easy to get stuck in the words. And so what these sutras do is they're trying to get us unstuck from the words, but of course they're using words.
Mm-hmm.
So you gotta read these sutras with a grain of salt in your tea.
It's why we meditate.
Exactly. Yes.
It's why
we can't really help us.
What?
So you can't really help us.
No, that's just what I was saying. That's why we meditate. Yeah, that's why we meditate. And that's, so that's part two. So it's just so I think I'm going to go on to part three.
For sake of time and sanity, we should move
what?
Forward. For sake of time and sanity.
Okay. So part three. So having introduced emptiness and the Prajnaparamita and applied it to the Abhidharma of the Sarvastivadins, so what can we do? Are we just going to get caught up on that flypaper with the words, the concepts? And so part three is providing an alternative and then delineates the bodhisattva path, which avoids concepts, which avoids dharmas that have any self-reality. So part three, therefore Shariputra, without any attainment, bodhisattvas take refuge in Prajnaparamita. Now, Prajnaparamita is locative in the Sanskrit. You have to have the word in here. Prajnaparamita is a goddess. And what this sutra does is it teaches you to enter the womb. You're all going back to the womb when you read this sutra. You enter the womb of Prajnaparamita, of the goddess. And so these bodhisattvas, what they do, they take refuge in the goddess of Prajnaparamita, in this ultimate wisdom, this pre-knowledge, this knowledge before there's any knowledge. And of course, sitting on the meditation cushion is one of the best ways to do this. But you can also do it working in the fields. So bodhisattvas take refuge in this Prajnaparamita, not as a concept. And thus they live without walls of the mind. Because if you have a concept, you've built walls around you. We live in cities of walls, of all the concepts we have. And so bodhisattvas have gotten rid of the walls because they've used the light of emptiness to shine on all the walls, and all the walls dissolve. They turn out to be no walls at all. And they live without walls. And because they live without walls, they're free of fears. When we have walls, we always wonder and worry about what's on the other side of the wall. But when the walls are gone, so are our fears of our spiritual life and our future life. Yeah?
Sorry, you mean to interrupt.
Oh, okay.
But I had a question when you
asked. Okay. Well, yeah, ask it.
Oh, okay. It was about the phrase without attainment, which I think for some could be a little paradoxical because it seems you attain something here, but of course the text is trying to say not. I'm interested because you know I read Chinese too, and the Chinese phrase seems like it almost could be read as because of non-attainment, bodhisattvas take refuge in Prajnaparamita. It's got the non-attainment, I don't know how to pronounce it in Japanese.
Here, let me look at the text.
You know, on your book page, I think it's an important philosophical point. I'm not just trying to be grammatical here. Beginning of part three in your book, page 129, it's point 21.
Okay.
And I'm not questioning your translation.
Yeah.
You say, therefore, Shariputra, without attainment, and then the next line, bodhisattvas take refuge. But if you look at the Chinese with Shariputra in parentheses, you have, you know, non-attainment, those three characters in the middle of the five-character phrase, and before that and after that, those two Chinese characters can mean because of or by virtue of.
Right?
So I'm curious how that works logically in your mind. Could it be?
It doesn't work at all.
Thank you.
No, stop. My translation is from the Sanskrit, not the Chinese.
That's what I thought, because I was having trouble deriving your English from the Chinese.
I included the Chinese in my book for usefulness,
okay.
Because so many people I followed the Chinese translations more.
Okay.
In Japan, the Japanese translations
okay.
of the Chinese. So I made sure that the Xuanzang's,
yes,
the monk Xuanzang's
sure.
translation would be in the book for comparison.
But you're deriving it from Sanskrit.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, then
yeah.
my other 16 questions are disappearing.
Okay.
Good. Thank you. We can talk about Chinese later over tea.
So that's not, I should have mentioned that. I don't know Sanskrit. But
so why are you translating?
But I'm a translator, so I can do these things. One thing a translator learns, there's a couple things you learn. First of all, how to use a dictionary. That's one thing they learn. And they also learn that when you translate, there's room. There's stuff going on. Both in poetry and spiritual texts, I, as a translator, have learned that the words are just the surface of what attracted you to translate this text or this poem. But what's really going on is non-linguistic. And so that gives me a lot of freedom.
I have a quick question. When you say that they take refuge in the goddess,
yes.
didn't Buddha teach that there are no gods or goddesses?
No.
No?
But I mean, well, the scriptures are always talking about gods and goddesses.
Yeah,
but
not
because,
as a point of
yeah, well, what
worship,
Buddhism,
I mean, I guess.
Yeah, what Buddhism did historically is it always adapted itself to whatever the local religions were. And would just incorporate everybody and just find a place for them. when a Buddhist teacher would go into a village and talk, if they had a belief in a certain god or goddess, and they would want to know, well, how does our god and goddess fit into that? And they would always find a place, put them on a mountain or something.
Social etiquette.
Yeah. It's just a skillful means of how you don't want to annoy the people you're trying to help. And also the reason why I translated from Sanskrit is there was this discovered when I was doing the Diamond Sutra that the Sanskrit made much more sense than the Chinese, and so I got into this habit of looking at Sanskrit texts. And in the case of the Heart Sutra, there's this Chinese scholar, actually he's not a scholar, Chinese businessman, published a book with every translation in every language in print of the Heart Sutra. 184 different versions of the Heart Sutra. And included in that was every known copy of the Sanskrit of the Heart Sutra. All the Chinese translations of it. All the Tibetan translations of the Heart Sutra. So I was able to compare, without me necessarily knowing that much Sanskrit, I was able to see all the different versions of how these other people were translating it, both in either writing it in Sanskrit or translating it into word languages that I knew, German or Chinese or that's it, German and Chinese. Anyway, and plus it's a really short text; it's hard to go wrong because there's so many people have written commentaries on it that there's only one phrase in the entire sutra where people have different opinions. And we haven't gotten there yet, but we're almost there. We're almost there. Where people actually have different opinions about the grammar. So without walls of the mind, and thus without fears, they see through delusions and finally nirvana. This is the line that there is ambiguity both in Sanskrit and in Chinese, and it could be read two different ways. Actually, it can't be. I should say, the ambiguity exists in Sanskrit if you accept the legitimacy of a copy of the Heart Sutra that didn't appear until 500 years after the first copy appeared. And around 730, we get what's called the long version of the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra, you know, doesn't have the standard sutra opening where the Buddha's sitting there and then the disciples are all gathered around. It just suddenly Avalokiteshvara is there and looking at the skandhas. But there is a long version of the Heart Sutra where they have the Buddha and everything, and then this story unfolds about Avalokiteshvara doing this. And in that version, the Sanskrit verb prapti appears in this line, and only in the long version of the Heart Sutra. In no version of the short version do we get the verb prapti. And the reason why that's important is if you have the verb prapti, you could say, they see through delusions and finally attain nirvana. Oh. So somebody wanted that attainment back in the sutra. Mm-hmm. It's the same prapti that we saw in line 20 about attainment and non-attainment. That's prapta. The verb is prapta. And it exists in all versions of the sutra in that line. But in this line, only the long version, a very late version, that doesn't appear till 7:30, says they see through delusions and finally attain nirvana. But again, none of the short versions have the word prapta or prapti in that line.
Question?
Yes.
So you're saying that they see through nirvana?
They see through, exactly. That's my interpretation. And you will not find any sutra of the Prajnaparamita literature where bodhisattvas attain nirvana. Not one. They lead others to nirvana, but they themselves do not enter nirvana.
Why?
Because it's a delusion. It's the ultimate
delusion.
Then
why would they want to lead others to nirvana?
Because they want to lead them to the hospital.
Okay.
They want them to...
They have to discover the delusion before they can get rid of it?
Yeah, exactly. They lead others to nirvana, as you might say, they give them a spiritual path. But they do not themselves enter nirvana. And so in the Prajnaparamita teachings, bodhisattvas never enter nirvana. And that's why I agree with the other copies of the Heart Sutra that do not include the word prapta, and I follow it here, that you see through delusions. And the ultimate delusion of the Sarvastivadins was nirvana. That was the ultimate thing that they thought you could attain, was nirvana. And so the sutra, again, is a rejection of the Sarvastivadin belief that dharmas, and nirvana is a dharma, could not be attained. Yeah, David.
Bill, I'll save my comment on the Chinese here for later, because this was a big conversation I wanted to have with you, but you're familiar with how some scholars, like Rupert Gethin, whom we've spoken about in his Foundations of Buddhism, says that some believe that the word nirvana can be a noun in Sanskrit.
Mm-hmm.
And that rather than to say attain nirvana, the sentences can often be read one nirvanas. And if you use that reading of nirvana as a verb, your English rendering here could have a double entendre. And I'm just curious, I don't think you intended it, but see through delusions and finally nirvana. As a verb.
As a verb.
Mm-hmm. I see that.
Do you see that in the Sanskrit as a possible rendering?
No.
You don't see it as possibly a verb?
No.
In this sentence? Because I love it as a possibility.
Well, I don't.
Well, because then you throw up an object that you're seeing through.
I don't like it at all.
I knew you don't. And you're given the reasons. Although even if you drop the word attain, nirvana as a verb, it's no longer the object of...
I'm going to talk with Rupert about that if I ever see him again. But I'm not aware of the idea that nirvana can be a verb.
Okay.
I actually exchanged some emails about this particular line with Andrew Schelling at Naropa about 10 years ago when I was first working on it to get the grammar right. And he didn't have any comments. He didn't about the verb. The idea that it could be a verb.
Okay.
The nirvana. But again, yeah, I know nothing about Sanskrit other than I know where my dictionary is on the shelf, and this is what I came up with.
But so the verb to see through, as you have it, which in the Sanskrit is in your text, atikranto.
Yeah.
So you have viparasha atikranto, to see through upside down thinking or delusions.
Yes.
And then nishta nirvana, finally nirvana. If nirvana is an, if you also see through, so viparasha is, so why isn't the verb at the beginning? If viparasha, that is delusion, and also nirvana are objects of this verb to see through, Why doesn't the verb come first and then the two objects afterwards?
Oh, but Sanskrit's always doing that.
Does it really?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
Things jump around a lot in Sanskrit. That's why it's so hard.
Okay.
To know sometimes grammatically what's going on, and they can just add one thing after another. They're worse than the Germans.
Yeah. So are you playing with that ambiguity in order to make an important philosophical, religious point?
No. I'm not playing with them. I'm hands-on.
Are you being creative with the grammar in order to make the interpretation that you think is important, that this is not about an attainment. It's about seeing through the whole notion of attainment.
Yeah, but yeah. I'm not. What do you mean playing with
it? Well, I'm sorry. You're making a creative interpretation of the Sanskrit, which not all would agree with.
Really?
You said that yourself, sir.
Oh, well, I don't think so. Again, I had at my disposal every existent translation.
I'm not saying you're mistaken at all, but that you're playing with some ambiguity in the text and saying, I think it might go this way because it makes more sense.
Well, it agrees with the Sanskrit. It's not denied by the Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. And if you don't read it the way I'm reading it here, then you've denied what all the other sutras say about nirvana in relationship to bodhisattvas. Mm-hmm. You're saying that this is not a Prajnaparamita sutra, because in all the Prajnaparamita sutras, bodhisattvas avoid,
right.
They explicitly avoid nirvana. So why would you suddenly have in the Heart Sutra, the heart of Prajnaparamita, having them attain nirvana?
No, I think your logic is really tight and good here, although it assumes thematic consistency across the different texts in the Shona.
Yeah.
And you are assuming that.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a good reason to assume that.
Well, I spent a lot of time on this issue,
yeah.
Because, again, the Long Sutra had the idea of attainment.
Right.
And there's always people who want to attain.
Well put.
And I wasn't having any of it. But, anyway, feel free to attain.
That's what I want.
And if you do, please let me know. I'd like to find out. That really helped me a lot.
If you're erasing all the lines everywhere,
yes,
and everything is one or whole,
not two.
Nirvana is a delusion, and so is suffering. Correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Why did the Buddha attain nirvana?
Well, people said he did.
People said he's, yeah.
He entered nirvana. He was done. He'd done what he could do. But I don't know what the Buddha would say about himself. I wouldn't put words in his mouth, it's a good question, and I have no answer for it.
Could we hold questions for a few minutes?
Okay.
And hear your teaching?
Okay, yes. All right, I'll just go through. We have one more part.
Yes.
Right?
We're not done. We still have...
Well, okay.
We're 26.
Oh, okay, and because they've seen through delusions, and including nirvana, this is what bodhisattvas can do. If they take refuge in Prajnaparamita, in this state, in not knowing the state of what was that Christian book?
The
cloud of unknowing.
Yeah.
This is similar to that. So they take refuge in the cloud of unknowing, of pre-knowledge, and this is also what all Buddhas did. So of the past, the present, and the future, they also took refuge in Prajnaparamita. Again, the Sanskrit, they have case endings here, and this is all locative. In. And thus they realized and excelled perfect enlightenment. Therefore, Shariputra, you should know the great mantra of Prajnaparamita. A mantra is like a magic spell. There's a lot of adjectives to describe this mantra. It's a mantra of great magic. Or, again, the word I translate magic is vidya. It means a kind of knowledge. It's esoteric knowledge. And so very often the word vidya was applied to magicians, great magicians, people who knew things that you didn't know. And thus, the word maha vidya, great vidya, was a personal term applied to a lot of the goddesses in ancient India. Lakshmi, Saraswati, all those great goddesses of ancient India were given that as an appellation. You know, like the great knowing one, or what, you know, sort of like the great hero, the great magician, the great magic one, the great Vidya. So this mantra is connected with all of these female goddesses of great magic. It's the unexcelled mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, which heals all suffering, which is the bottom line in Buddhism. If it doesn't heal suffering, then it's not worth messing with. But this mantra does. But it does it in a way that doesn't encourage you to resort to those old conceptual schemes. It does it with something else, and it heals as a result, because it is true and not false. And the mantra in Prajnaparamita, again, it's always in Prajnaparamita, spoken thus: Gate Gate Paragate Parasangate Bodhisvaha. Now the question, of course, mantras often make sense. You could actually analyze the words and get sense out of them, but you don't necessarily have to take the sense as being significant. That is, sometimes they make sense, sometimes it's just the sound, the power of the sound of the words, which have efficacy. In this case, you get a mantra that makes sense and has efficacy in terms of its sounds. And the Sanskrit word is gate here, which is a bit odd, because normally you would have expected the word gata. And so there have been different scholars have wondered what case this is in. And if my reasoning is correct, that it's all taking place in Prajnaparamita, then once again, it's locative masculine in this case. And it's gate means into the gone. And so by chanting this mantra, you are actually entering the womb of Prajnaparamita. Entering the womb. Into the gone beyond. Into the gone completely beyond. And that's the function of this mantra, to get you into Prajnaparamita. And then at the very end, Bodhisvaha. Bodhi, of course, meaning wisdom and enlightenment. And Svaha was an expression put in India. You had everybody had rituals, and Svaha was a very common way of saying Hallelujah, or Amen.
That's a great translation.
Yeah, and also, of course, at the very end, you it has Svaha is Sva by itself means self, and Ha. So it's just a little joke on the self.
I used to translate it as
yeehaw. So anyway, we've made it to the end. So in a sense, the sutra is all about addressing an audience that might be conversant with this Abhidharma, the Sarvastivadins, getting them to think differently about it, but giving them something in its place. So, other than a new conceptual scheme. So instead of giving a new conceptual scheme, it gives them this gate, this mantra you chant to get yourself into that womb, where you then are reborn as a Buddha. Because Prajnaparamita has always been called the mother of all Buddhas. All Buddhas come from Prajnaparamita.